From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we consider Russia's position on America's push toward war with Iraq. We talk with Bill Keller, a New York Times columnist and former Moscow bureau chief. He just returned from Russia. Also, we meet actress Lupe Ontiveros. She stars as a mother at odds with her teenage daughter in the new film Real Women Have Curves. Bonnie Hunt talks about her new sitcom, and critic Milo Miles reviews the reissue of the 1965 debut album by the eccentric folk musician Michael Hurley. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. The news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The White House says it will use diplomacy to address North Korea's admission that it has been developing a secret nuclear weapons program. NPR's Don Gagne reports from the White House.
The Bush administration's reaction to this news out of North Korea is very different from its approach to Iraq. Both countries were listed by the president early this year as being part of an axis of evil. Now the White House is talking about a possible war with Iraq to prevent it from developing nuclear weapons. But the president says diplomacy is the answer regarding North Korea. Mr. Bush's spokesman said the president sees these developments as both sobering and troubling. But the spokesman also said this is a very different situation from Iraq, noting that the threat posed by Saddam Hussein is unique. The president has not yet publicly commented on the North Korean nuclear weapons program, but administration officials say this is clearly a violation of the Non-Proliferation Treaty. Don Gagne, NPR News, The White House.
Investigators in the Washington area sniper murder say a witness description from the latest killing has turned out not to be credible. Police say a witness who described the sniper, a cream-colored van, and an assault weapon may have made the story up. It was a setback for investigators who put a lot of energy into trying to find a cream-colored van with a malfunctioning rear taillight based on the witness description. A police chief said other details in the media, including a reported description of the suspect and his weapon, are also unreliable. Police returned to the scene of the latest shooting, a shopping mall in Falls Church, Virginia, looking for more evidence in the sniping murder of a 47-year-old woman who worked for the FBI. A former top energy trader at Enron Corporation has pleaded guilty to fraud for his role in manipulating California's power crisis. NPR's Elaine Corey reports from San Francisco.
Timothy Belden, who ran Enron's trading office in Portland, Oregon, pleaded guilty in U.S. District Court to one count of conspiracy to commit wire fraud. As part of a plea bargain, Belden will help prosecutors in their case against more senior Enron officials. Belden has been called the mastermind of the company's strategy to profit from California's energy crisis. At a time of rolling blackouts, Enron would move energy supplies out of the state to avoid price caps and then sell it back to California at huge markups. Belden could be sentenced to 5 years in prison for his role. Elaine Corey, NPR News, San Francisco.
Stock prices closed higher today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 239 points, or 2.9%, to close at 8,274 in heavy trading. Advancing issues led declines by more than 2-to-1. The Nasdaq Composite Index gained 39 points, that's 3.2%. It closed at 1,272. This is NPR News. A federal judge has ordered the Bush administration to identify the energy industry lobbyists and business people who met with Vice President Dick Cheney and top members of his energy task force last year. District Judge Emmett Sullivan told Justice Department lawyers that the White House must hand over all documents that aren't covered by executive privilege by November 5th. The watchdog group Judicial Watch, the Sierra Club, and the General Accounting Office are suing for the information. Lawyers for the Justice Department said they'll seek to have the judge's order suspended. The widow of a Philadelphia man who got an artificial heart last year is suing the company that makes the experimental device. NPR's Richard Knox reports.
James Quinn was the fifth patient to have his natural heart replaced with a new pump made of titanium and plastic. 9 months later, the 52-year-old man suffered a stroke that caused brain death. Last August 26, doctors turned the pump off. Now Quinn's widow, Irene, is suing Abiomed, a Massachusetts company that makes the artificial heart, and Hahnemann University Hospital in Philadelphia, where the surgery was performed. Mrs. Quinn says the company and the hospital failed to inform her husband fully about the experiment he was signing up for. Months before his death, the couple had hired a lawyer. In a statement, Abiomed says it's disappointed Mrs. Quinn is suing. The company says the experiment will continue. Richard Knox, NPR News, Boston.
Sun Microsystems announced today that it's cutting its workforce by 11% in an effort to reduce its losses from the technology slowdown. The announcement marks the second round of cuts for the California-based computer maker. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Procter & Gamble, makers of Metamucil Daily Fiber Therapy with 100% natural fiber for maintaining regularity the natural way. Metamucil.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. New York Times op-ed columnist Bill Keller returned last week from a three-week trip to Russia. After watching a popular Russian TV talk show, whose subject was the possibility of war with Iraq, Keller wrote, "You could fairly sum up the Russian consensus about Iraq this way. In threatening Iraq, President Bush is mainly after cheap oil and probably some cheap votes in the next election. America may pretend to be promoting lofty democratic ideals, but America likes the tyrants who serve its interests. The Bush overtures to the UN are laughably insincere, and whatever happens, it will be bad for Russia and terrible for ordinary Iraqis. America could care less about that." Bill Keller was the New York Times Moscow bureau chief from 1989 to 91. He later served as the paper's foreign editor. Since 2001, he's been a columnist and a senior writer for the Times magazine. I asked him to explain where the Russian government stands on the possibility of America going to war with Iraq.
Russia's official position is strongly opposed, and it matters, among other reasons, because they have a veto on the Security Council at the UN. President Putin says he is not convinced that Saddam represents the kind of threat that America says he is. I think in the end, if America does end up going to war against Iraq, Putin probably will not stand in the way. He's already shown that he's willing to, when it comes down to the final decision, to accommodate American interests. He wants to be a member of the kind of club of civilized countries, and thinks that's important for Russia, and he's right in that. And so he's given in to the administration on things like the ABM treaty, on NATO expansion, and I'm sure he would at least not be the kind of sole barrier to an American invasion. His opposition is very popular in Russia. I think the prevailing view there, it was interesting just to step outside of our little self-absorbed world and look at us from somewhere else. I have a kind of long fondness for Russia, so it happens to be a set of bleachers that I like to look at the world from. And there is a deep cynicism among Russians, and I think this is true in much of Europe and much of the Middle East, probably a fair part of Asia, the cynicism about our motivations. People say that they think it's really about oil. They think that America doesn't really care what the rest of the world thinks. And they think whatever happens is probably going to be bad for Iraq and bad for Russia.
What are Russia's interests in Iraq and the Persian Gulf region?
They have real interests, and I think legitimate interests. Part of the problem is getting the administration to publicly acknowledge this. Russia has very few countries that are willing to buy its manufactured products. They can always sell oil and other minerals and timber and things like that. But to be a developed country, you have to sell things that you make, and there aren't very many customers for the things that Russia makes. Three of them happen to be the countries that we call the Axis of Evil: Iraq, Iran, and North Korea. And Iraq is a big customer for Russia. There's about $4 billion a year in sales, which for Russia is serious money. A lot of that is equipment related to the oil industry, there are a lot of Russians working in the Iraqi oil fields. So that's one big interest. Another is that Russia is a big oil producer itself. And there are there's a real fear in Russia that if the United States goes in and kind of controls the Iraqi oil flow, we will be strongly tempted to pump a lot of oil out of Iraq to drive down the price so that we can have cheap oil. If we drive down the price of oil, that could have devastating consequences for Russia's economy.
Iraq also owes Russia billions of dollars.
That's right. They have a longstanding debt. There's some considerable argument about whether they would ever collect that with or without Saddam Hussein, but they do have real debts. The administration's public posture on this is, well, they haven't really had a public posture on this. I guess my suspicion is that they're saving it as a bargaining chip for somewhere sort of in the end game when they want Russia to either abstain in a Security Council vote or in some other way, stand aside in the event of a military intervention. They'll be able to, they will say, in exchange for this, we will promise that you get a place near the front of the line when we pay off the countries that are owed by Iraq.
Now, in addition to the fact that Russia could cast a veto vote in the Security Council, what would be the advantages of having Russia on our side if we do go to war with Iraq?
Well, I think it's highly unlikely that Russia would actually participate in a war with Iraq. I think there's an advantage in having Russia on our side, period. All three of these countries that the administration has put at the top of their list as potential threats to us, they're neighbors and trading partners of Russia. Russia has relationships with them that could be useful to us. Specifically in Iraq, if we go in, the Russians really do know the lay of the land. They have a lot of people who work there. They know the oil industry, for example. In a larger sense, Russia does have all of that oil. And if Iraq changes hands, then probably the nature of OPEC and the nature of the world oil markets, which I do not pretend to be an expert in, but the nature of those markets is going to change. And having Russia as a significant partner in our own future supplies of oil would be extremely useful. And the other thing which is always worth remembering is, Russia is still I think Senator Biden refers to it as the candy store of candy stores. It is the world's largest repository of material that could be used in making a nuclear weapon. Securing that stuff and preventing it from getting into the hands of a terrorist depends on having a good, cordial, mutually respectful relationship with Russia.
Yeah, in this era where we're certainly very worried about a small nuclear device being used as a terrorist weapon within the United States or against American interests abroad, I'm wondering if during your trip to Russia, if you got a sense that the Russians were worried about rogue nuclear weapons or the use of, radium to create a nuclear weapon, because Russia has so many nuclear weapons that are unaccounted for. Are they worried about this?
Not on this trip, but on an earlier trip in February, I spent quite a bit of time talking to people who deal with these issues in Russia, official people and then Russians. There are a number of think tanks that have largely been subsidized by American foundations to help deal with this issue. And yes, they are concerned. They take the threat of terrorism seriously. I mean, sometimes they're a little facile about, using the war on terror to kind of justify what they're doing in Chechnya. But they do realize that terrorism is a threat that touches them. There are conflicting pressures there. One of them is the nuclear industry in Russia is a fairly powerful constituency, has been for a long time. And under its previous leaders, it did a lot of kind of sub rosa business with Iran, maybe with other places. And they've tended to regard nuclear material as a commodity rather than a threat. I'm told that has changed pretty substantially. Putin and Bush have talked about it. They talked about it in their meeting in Crawford early this year. And I think the Russians take it much more seriously. But it's there's still a lot of things that slow it down. One of them is the commercial interests. Another one is the just mutual suspicion. You know, we're willing to pay the Russians to put up fences and detectors around bunkers where they keep their weapons and to help them dilute highly enriched uranium so that it can't be used in making a homemade bomb. But that requires access. And on both sides, the militaries on both sides have been reluctant to grant the kind of access that's necessary to really get those programs going.
I don't know if you have a sense of this or not, but, you know, President Bush and Putin were getting along pretty well before September 11th, and now they're not seeing eye to eye on Iraq. What do you think that's done to their relationship?
You know, we always slightly over-personalize our international relations. I think that's a peculiarly American foible. You know, the first President Bush fell madly in love with Mikhail Gorbachev to the point where he was blinded to the fact that Gorbachev was losing it. You know, Bill Clinton had this tempestuous love affair with Boris Yeltsin. The thing that I've kind of liked about the relationship between Bush and Putin is that it's been a much more sober, I mean, literally and figuratively, kind of business-like, pragmatic relationship. It's mostly been one way. The U.S. says, we want to do this, and the Russians, after objecting and objecting and objecting, say, okay. But Russia hasn't, up until September 11th, Russia had not been treated as an irrelevance. They've gotten a much greater say in NATO. We have a new arms control agreement with them, which the Russians very much wanted and liked. So, you know, up until September 11th, the relationships really seemed to be on a kind of surprisingly mature footing. But you can almost see Putin wince now, you know, at the American attitude. There is a kind of, you know, you remember the Lily Tomlin character back in Saturday Night Live, the telephone operator. You know, we don't care, we don't have to, we're the phone company.
Right, Ernestine.
Yeah, Ernestine. I think that's what the Russians hear when George Bush talks. You know, there's a petulance and an impatience. And, you know, I don't sit in the room with the two men, so I don't know how, if at all, it's affected their personal relationship. But it's certainly affected the body language and the tone. And it's affected the way the Russian elites, so the Russian intellectuals and officials and commentators there think about us.
Well, Bill Keller, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
A pleasure.
Bill Keller is an op-ed columnist for The New York Times and a senior writer for The Times magazine. Coming up, Lupe Ontiveros, star of the new film Real Women Have Curves. This is Fresh Air. If you saw actress Lupe Ontiveros, you'd likely recognize her from one of her many roles as a maid. That is, unless you recognized her as the murderer in the film Selena, which starred Jennifer Lopez as the young Latina pop star. The role Ontiveros considers her breakthrough was in the recent independent film Chuck and Buck, in which she played a theater manager. Now Ontiveros is starring in the new movie Real Women Have Curves. It won the Dramatic Audience Award at this year's Sundance Film Festival. Ontiveros plays Carmen, a strict mother of two daughters. Her younger daughter has won a scholarship to Columbia University, but Carmen wants her to stay home and work in her older sister's dress factory. Another conflict revolves around weight. Carmen and her two daughters are heavy, and she often pressures the younger one to slim down. In this scene, they're both in a restaurant where Carmen is eating a rich flan. She's just returned from the doctor where she expected to have confirmation that she's pregnant and instead was told she's going through menopause.
Mom, the doctor said no sugar. Why are you eating the flan?
I'm having a cravings.
But you're not pregnant, Mom.
Okay, I'm not pregnant. I'm going to the change of life. It's over. I'm no longer a woman.
Mom.
A grandmother is what I should be at this age. You know, Anna, you're not bad looking. If you lost weight...
Just stop it.
You could be beautiful.
Stop it. You're overweight, too. So why should I listen to you?
Anna, don't eat the flan.
In Real Women Have Curves, and in a bunch of your movies, you have an accent, which you don't have in real life. Who are some of the voices that have been in your head that you've drawn on for the accent that you've used in your movies?
Oh, none at all. I mean, it's an art. You know, you just apply it when you have to. And I've gone up for auditions, and when I speak the way I do and I think the way I you hear me thinking, I don't get the part because a woman like me, I'm too, I guess, too peasant-looking, ethnic-looking, whatever, and I'm a mamacita, and I have to sound and look like one. I mean, I look like one, but I have to sound like one, and I don't get the part. Now, there was a difference. There was a time where it didn't matter, and that was because Miguel Alteta from Chuck and Buck said, I have a role for you. And as soon as he said, her name is Beverly, I said, you got it. I don't have to read the script. I'll do it. Her name is Beverly, for God's sake. It's not Concepcion Martinez de la Hoya and all this, you know.
Now, you estimate that you've played maids in about 150 movies and TV shows. I want you to run through just a list of some of the maids you've played.
Maids, oh my goodness, maids for everything. Look at, what's his name, Nicholson, Jack Nicholson in As Good As It Gets.
Mm-hmm.
That kind of a maid, where she's a religious kind of a very warm human being. And then there's the maid in what did I do recently with Todd Salon? Storytelling.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that was a creature to be reckoned with, one of these wretched human beings, you know.
You set the house on fire at the end. You're so resentful.
Oh, that was the best part. Yeah. I didn't know that I was going to do that until we were on the set. He says, you know, you're going to blow up the house. I said, oh, boy. Boy, have I wanted to do this for a long time. And I see maids, Beverly Hills maids, office maids. What can I tell you? It's always somebody else's maid, you know. I'm always doing a service for someone else. But I'll tell you this much, that I've done it very proudly. Because as I said before to folks, I said, those folks, those hands, those people that come to bring you the service to your table, to bring that pick your grapes and bring you the grapes to your table and through a glass of wine. The people that wash your latrine, that wash your kids, you know, that bring them peace, bring children peace at night when their parents aren't there. I think that I owe them to give their characters life and love and soul and humor. So it's really been a pleasure to do them.
Now, you were telling us you grew up in El Paso. Your parents owned a tortilla factory, and they owned restaurants as well. Do I have that right?
Yes, they had two restaurants.
So,
and properties and such. And they were not non-educated people. I was born and raised in Texas, in El Paso, Texas. It's a border town. And my parents had businesses. They had factories and restaurants. And the folks that would cross the border from Mexico, Ciudad Juarez, Mexico, to El Paso, Texas, were the people that worked at my mother's factories. And that was my greatest resource. That's where my hard drive went into action, storing all of those adventures and all those conversations I used to hear, all the dirty jokes I used to hear that I learned and, you know, behaviors and what have you.
You were a social worker for years. I mean, even when you started acting, you had a day job as a social worker. What kind of social work did you do?
Well, I worked in various facets of it. I was working with the developmentally disabled I worked for immigration. I worked for Head Start. I worked for senior with the seniors program, evaluating their services, what have you.
How did you start acting?
It was really a joke. It was on a dare to myself. I was, you know, in transition from one job to the other, and I came across an article in the paper that was looking for extras. And I kind of was talking out loud, and I said to my husband, what do you think about it? You think I should? I was trying to decide, should I go back and get a nursing degree? Should I do this? Should I do that? And there was that job opening there, and he said, do whatever the heck you want. Now he says he's sorry he said that. Because I do have a tendency to run with the ball, take the bull by the horns, and go with it.
So when you're walking through the streets and people recognize you, who do they often most recognize you as? What are the roles you're best known
Selena.
For? The killer of Selena.
I'm the killer of Selena. And so far, so good. I haven't had anybody chase me down the street. but there was a very interesting what happened one day. I was going into the ladies' restroom and I was going into the stall, and this lady just stood in front of me and grabbed me and pulled me out again. And she said, you are her, aren't you? I have a bet with my friend that you are she. And I said, excuse me? I knew where she was going. She said, you killed Selena, didn't you? And I said, let me go do my business. I'll come up and then I'll tell you. So she let go of me.
Yeah, so Selena is the
and
movie.
And it's the working class that recognizes me, and I'm very happy. You know what? The greatest graceful thing that happens to me by my people is that they give me their blessing. Nobody has to give anybody else a blessing. You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
And they come up and they say, you make me so proud. Your work makes me feel so proud to be a Latina. And I, you know, now coming to the present time is that we're praying that this film makes us even prouder.
Well, Lupe Ontiveros, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Lupe Ontiveros stars in the new film Real Women Have Curves. It opens in New York and Los Angeles this weekend and in more cities in the coming weeks. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. And by the Discovery Channel, presenting Behind the Headlines, a television event featuring Understanding Iraq and the Real Saddam, Friday at 9 p.m. on the Discovery Channel. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, more on how nuclear war was averted during the Cuban Missile Crisis. We continue our conversation with Peter Kornbluh of the National Security Archive. And Maureen Corrigan reviews Quentin's, the new novel by Maeve Binchy. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Comedian Bonnie Hunt has a new ABC sitcom called Life with Bonnie. She plays a woman with her hands full on two fronts. At work, she hosts the daily morning TV show Morning Chicago, in which she interviews guests, but is best known for her funny banter and monologues. At home, she has three kids and a busy husband who is a doctor. Life with Bonnie is Bonnie Hunt's fifth sitcom and the first that seems to be really catching on. Part of each episode features Bonnie hosting Morning Chicago. This part is improvised. Here she is on the air with the station's weatherman, Johnny Volcano, played by David Duchovny. Volcano has just made a new movie.
You know what? I'm embarrassed to start out with a question you probably get all the time. You know, so many people in our business change their names to suit their jobs, and you have such a fantastic name for yes. a weatherman, Johnny Volcano.
Yeah, I'm guilty of that.
Are yep. you really? That's yep. not your real name, then?
No. My name was Victor.
Victor?
Victor Volcano.
I would have never guessed that. But, you know, there's a lot of things I don't know about you. Now you're making movies. That's very exciting.
That's right. Well, there's a lot of attention being generated by the film I did. A lot of heat, as we say. There's a buzz.
Buzz.
There's a buzzing.
Buzzing.
About the film that I did.
You mean in the film community?
No, in the weather community.
Well, it's certainly an untapped market. I mean, there's a lot of people out there in the weather community looking for entertainment. And you just one day you're doing the weather and you say, listen, I'm going to write and direct and act in this movie.
And star.
Star.
Yeah.
Write, direct, and starred. In,
a version equivalent.
A version equivalent. Wow, that's the first...
A.E.
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 Bonnie Hunt, welcome to Fresh Air. Because your character in Life with Bonnie is the host of a local morning TV show, you must have had to watch a lot of those shows so you'd know what you were writing. So did you spend a lot of time watching local and national talk shows?
No, I didn't, but I have spent a lot of time on those shows. As an actress, certainly one of at my level where you're a character actress, when a movie comes out like The Green Mile or Jerry Maguire or Jumanji, you're sent on the road and you go state to state every single day doing local morning talk shows. And I've done that for the last 10 years whenever I've had a movie come out. And it's been quite an experience. And it's been fun. You meet all these different characters and see the way these people's lives are and what their local shows, what's hip on them, what their little niche is, what their catchphrases are. But for the most part, this just stems from Don Lake and I just writing it as performers. You know, what would be a fun morning talk show? And mostly, too, it comes from Bonnie Malloy's point of view, you know, the character's point of view on the show.
Now, one of the things your character, Bonnie, is famous for is that she really doesn't read the books. And she does a lot of, like, cheating. And she's not famous for being prepared. She's famous for being funny and really entertaining and telling great stories. Did you get interviewed by a lot of people in those years on the road who really didn't have a clue who you were?
That is a great question. And absolutely, it happened all the time. And you can tell the difference when somebody's faking their way through an interview. And, you know, halfway through, you're finding yourself so insulted that you're thinking, I came down here at 6:30 a.m. and you haven't read one thing. At least read my resume. And that happens all the time. And I think for the character that I'm playing on the show, you know, her priority is her family and her children. And when she gets home, she's just deeply ensconced in that situation. So she's willing to forgo the reading of an extra book or whatever she has to prepare for the next day, and that she'll wing that part of her life, her professional part of her life, but not her personal part of her life.
Now, how did you learn how to wing doing an interview when the person interviewing you really didn't have a clue who you were?
I usually used humor. You know, I would just, sometimes I would call a spade and say, you don't know anything I've done, do you? And the crew would laugh, you know, the good morning, the whatever it was, crew would laugh. But for the most part, you know, you just get through the interview and hopefully have some honesty and integrity because people respond to it. They do. People at home watching either get it or they don't. And I certainly don't want to be a phony to them.
I think this is your fifth sitcom. Do I have that right?
Yes, my fifth time out.
And this one looks like it's doing very well in the ratings so far. Did you sit down and wonder what went wrong with the others? Why weren't they hits? And are there lessons I want to learn from that? Or things I want to ignore about those lessons because I just want to do it my way, one or the other? I mean, what kind of, like, diagnosis did you do on the other shows?
Well, it is true. You do take the time to reflect. I mean, not only during the process, but afterwards and then when things don't pan out, you know, with the best case scenario, you do think, what could I change? What could I do differently? But I've always been fortunate enough to, in the moment, remember to fail by my own standards. So I live with little regret about those times. I always did my best job. I maintained my creative integrity. And when in doubt, I would walk out. And that's what I did with the building. I mean, that series was picked up by the network. It was renewed. But creatively, they wanted to make so many changes that I canceled it myself. And, you know, it was hard for them to understand that because I was turning down a lot of money. And the opportunity for a regular job in this business is very seductive. But I didn't regret that because that show became my calling card for the next show that I eventually wrote and produced, The Bonnie Hunt Show. And that had a similar fate. I was at the changing of the guard at the network, but it was a good show, and everybody, they did their best, but we just didn't get the ratings, and that happens. This show, I believe, I took the combination of what was best of those last two shows and the films that Don and I have written, and just the experience does help you a lot. Like you said, you know, what do you take? What did you learn? What do you forget? What do you bring back with you? You know, you do take an inventory, but for the most part, I knew I wanted to put myself in a situation where I could play at the top of my intelligence and yet be vulnerable. And I don't know if I had all those qualities in the other shows.
Can you describe some of the things the network wanted you to do to change the building, things you didn't like so that you ended the series?
Yeah, it was not so, you know, every time that they come to you with notes, if they're thought-provoking and we're all respectful to each other, I'm always willing to work at the table and negotiate creatively. My situation at CBS at the time was not one of creative respect. It was a constant power struggle. And when they came to me to discuss the show, it wasn't, we think this is best for the show or we think this would be more creative. It was just, we want you to replace three of the actors with actors that we already have on hold at the network for development deals. It was not a decision that was made in the best interest of the show. It was just a decision that was made because there was somebody in a position of power that had people that were on hold and under contract they were paying money to that were just going to be plugged into my show. And I thought it would jilt it right out of everything that we had worked so hard up until that point to display and to build for our characters. And their theory, and I said, these are my friends that I work with. I do not want to call them and say, the show's picked up, but you're not on it. And the executive at the time offered to make the phone calls himself. And I said, that's really not the point. So, you know, it was a valuable lesson for me and I'm sure for them as well. I mean, they came back to me 6 months later with double the money to do another series, and I did the next series with them, but not this one.
My guest is Bonnie Hunt. Her new ABC sitcom is called Life with Bonnie. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Bonnie Hunt is my guest. She co-created and stars in the new TV series Life with Bonnie. Did you do stand-up early in your career?
No, I never did do stand-up. I've always been an ensemble performer. It's what I love. It's what I'm comforted by. I'm 6 out of 7 children, so I guess it's just what I'm used to. The essence of teamwork is inspiring to me, and I'm constantly motivated by it creatively.
Now, you started an improv group with Joan Cusack, the actress. Why did you want to start your own group? Chicago's famous for its improv groups, including Second City.
Well, I think in the 80s, improvisation was so at the forefront, especially in Chicago and New York. And Second City is a theater that I grew up going to, I mean, since I was 13, 14 years old with my folks. But at the time when I met Joan and Holly Wartell, who's also on my show now, I was a nurse. I worked at Northwestern University in Chicago in the oncology department. But I was an avid Second City fan, and I would go sometimes 2-3 nights a week to see the improvisational sets. And then when the auditions came up, eventually I tried out. But during that time at night, while we were all trying to get into the Second City, Joan Cusack, Holly Wartell, and myself were in a company called An Impulsive Thing. We were the three girls with about 7 guys. And we worked at a place called Bob's Bar, which was across the street from Wrigley Field in Chicago. And it was a fantastic, incredible experience. I'll probably never be able to replicate it. The joy, the teamwork. It was all about putting on a good show. We did 45 minutes of new material nightly. It was kind of a potpourri of the talent of the group, all mixed up together, all the different takes we had on things.
Now, you started your professional life as a nurse with people with cancer. Why did you go into nursing? Did you always really want to go into performing?
I just love to be around people, and I think that performing is kind of like a caregiving situation. I think my patients obviously were truly inspirational. I mean, when you're dealing with people that are at the end of their lives, you are given a gift of a certain perspective that at the age of, you know, 20, 21 years old, you probably would never even cross your mind. So in that respect, I loved being a nurse. I wanted to be a nurse. I gave 150% to being a nurse. But at the same time, I always had this kind of tug, this calling to be an entertainer. I've always loved it. And I was able to do both for a long time. I worked at Second City at night while I worked at the hospital during the day. And then eventually I worked with a patient named Rudy that had only a few weeks to live. And I had been taking care of him for months. And he said to me, when are you going to go to California and really try to be a writer, director, a storyteller? Because that's what you're so good at. And I was sitting next to his bed talking to him. And I said, oh, you know, I'd hate to go and then fail and have to come back and explain everything and then get my job back at the hospital. And he said, Bonnie, I only have a little time left to live. And I want to tell you the biggest regret in my life is that I feared failure. So I want you to promise me that you will go to California and you will fail many times. And I said, okay, Rudy, I will. And I did, and I have.
Did you never go back to nursing after that?
I always went back. I went back for years. I would work over the holidays at the same hospital, and then eventually I moved on to the VA hospital and worked with the vets and continued it for a long time, and now I have a relationship with the doctors that I worked for at Northwestern for fundraising for cancer research.
So when you were a nurse, would you entertain the patients?
The patients really got involved with the fact that I did these shows at night. It added, I think, another and better layer to my skills as a nurse and the heartfelt moments between the patients and myself. I would often bring down the cast from Second City, and we would push the beds into the hallways, and we would do our show in the hallway for all the patients that were terminally ill that weren't on an outpatient basis. And they, in turn, would give me skit ideas that I would bring to the improv set. I would have them videotaped and the next day bring them back to the hospital to say, look what we did with your idea. They found great joy in it. They always inspired me and encouraged me. And I was able to give them something else that they could think about just for a moment to forget the anxiety and fear and pain that they might have been in at the time. And I found it just an important part of it. And I believe, you know, certainly I've had so much success because probably I have a lot of guardian angels.
So when you decided to leave the Chicago hospital where you worked and go to L.A. at the advice of one of your patients, what was your strategy when you got there?
Oh, I didn't have one. I had just been married, and my husband and I agreed that I would go for 6 months and give it a whirl because I had promised Rudy, and my husband thought it would be good for us, that our future, that at least I had given it a shot, and that I wouldn't live in what if I would have tried in years to come. So I went out to L.A. with the Second City Company. They opened a theater there in Santa Monica. I wrote and performed in the first review. And then Second City decided that they were going to do more of a TV format within their improvisational set. I had met Don Lake there. Don and I both agreed that creatively that was so the opposite of what Second City was. Second City for us was the U of C grads in the early 60s that were commenting on what was in the paper that day and what was happening in the country and on the news and not necessarily trying to do material that would end up as a sitcom. So we were kind of purist and decided that we would give 2 weeks' notice to the theater, which we both did. And it was a terrifying thing to do because it was the only income we had out in L.A. But within weeks, we were both rewarded with jobs on network television, which had its own creative battle. But that's what happened out there. I really didn't have a plan, and I was lucky enough to stay with many friends. in exchange for maybe cleaning up the house or, you know, paying the phone bill or whatever I could afford at the time.
My guest is Bonnie Hunt, the co-creator, writer, and star of the new TV series Life with Bonnie. So what was it like growing up with three brothers and three sisters?
Well, it was a joy. I mean, we didn't have a lot of money, but I never knew the difference because my mother was always an optimist and in a good mood, and she just set the tone. My father was hardworking, blue-collar, self-taught electrician. He worked 20 hours a day, but he had an incredible gift for storytelling. They were an incredible team. My father died when I was 18. He died from a heart attack, and then the kids just came together, and we all pitched in to make sure that we could keep the house and pay the bills and help take care of my mother, and she in turn helped take care of us. We always had our grandparents live with us when they got old and sick, and we took care of them until they passed away, and they were always in our home. I had an incredible childhood. There was a lot of bad moments and hectic moments and, you know, family politics and what have you, but for the most part, there at the core of it, there was unconditional love, and that's just about all a kid needs.
How many bathrooms did you have in the house?
We had one.
Uh-oh.
And then eventually my dad built another one.
How did so many of you make it out of the house in the morning with only one bathroom?
Or my mom would start ringing the bell. A couple of us were very early risers. My younger sister, Mary, and two of my older brothers were just early birds. And the other ones, you know, we would sleep in. There was just always just a revolving door, and somehow magically we would all get out of the house. But we were never, ever, ever on time for anything.
Now, I read that your mother used to sing.
Right. She sang for years. We used to sing on the Morris B. Sachs Radio Hour in Chicago, live from the Merchandise Mart. And she worked at NBC at the Merchandise Mart for years. She wrote for the soap operas and then worked for the president there eventually. Worked with him side by side until she had my first brother. And then she quit. And then, as she says, she gave birth to her audience.
Did she sing a lot around the house?
Always. She always sang around the house. And the song that I sang in the second episode of our show, the song Dream, was the song that she would sing at night if we couldn't sleep. And I remember asking her to sing it over and over and over again. She's also great on the piano. She plays by ear. She's just very gifted and talented and, very loving.
Did that inspire you to sing, too? Since she was so free singing around the house, did you grow up singing around the house, too?
The first time I remember singing, where I sang a whole song over and over again, was when our dog, Whiskey, had drowned in Lake Michigan. And I was inconsolable. And my mom said, the only way you're going to stop crying is if you sing, and you have to sing over and over and over again. You just got to keep singing until you stop crying. And I remember I sang You Are My Sunshine with her, and I kept singing it and singing it until I stopped crying. And it was just a valuable, it was nice. I think singing is comforting. At least it was, you know, in my memories.
So did you try that again as a kid?
Oh, yeah. I still do it till this day.
You sing when you're really sad?
Yes, absolutely.
Is your mother still alive?
Yes, very much so. She's getting a big kick out of this whole experience for me once again, and I hope that within her lifetime I will be able to succeed at one of these television ventures. I think it would do her heart good.
Have you thought about writing in a part for her?
My mom always ends up in everything that I do, whether she's there in person or just there in character. But she was in Return to Me, the movie that we did for MGM. She had a little part in that, and I would love to bring her out and have her do something.
Thank you so much for talking with us.
Oh, thank you. It was a nice interview.
Bonnie Hunt's new sitcom, Life with Bonnie, is broadcast Tuesday nights on ABC. Here's the scene from the series in which she sang Dream.
Dream when you're feeling blue. And they might come true. They never are as bad as they seem.
She sounds good.
So dream, dream, dream.
Coming up, Milo Miles reviews a reissue of the debut album by the eccentric folk musician Michael Hurley. This is Fresh Air. Michael Hurley's first album came out in 1965 on the prestigious label Folkways, but it wasn't like the other acoustic folk albums by Woody Guthrie and Leadbelly, and it sold poorly, eventually becoming a rarity. Hurley has never attracted more than a loyal cult audience, and it seemed his debut might never appear in the flood of CD reissues. Critic Milo Miles was always on the lookout for it, and now his patience has been rewarded.
No, 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 I won't go down no more. No, 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 I won't come down no more. No, no, I won't go. No, no, I won't go. No, 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 I won't come down no more.
The first Michael Hurley album I ever heard was called Armchair Boogie, and I thought, what kind of a title is Armchair Boogie? But I've come to think of it as his most apt, because Michael Hurley does music with a wild and wiggy interior life, but on the outside, it's relaxed and stays pretty much in the same place. You might say that although Hurley is folk in form, he's vintage rock and roll in sensibility. For many years, the Hurley album I most wanted was his debut, First Songs. Now, with no fanfare, it's been reissued as Blueberry Wine, and it was worth the wait. The universe it comes from is just as strange now as it was almost 40 years ago.
Down by the pool hall, clickety-clack, and you can knock those pool balls forth and back. I don't want you hanging around my little sister no more. You move along, you're rolling stone. You move along, you're rolling stone. You get down by the pool hall, clickety-clack, and you can knock those pool balls forth and back. I don't want you hanging around my little sister no more. You move along.
Hurley is one of those rare performers who sounds almost routine at first. But as you listen closer, you decide the guy is very peculiar. In the song we just heard, he's warning lowlifes away from his little sister. In another song, he's a lowlife himself, just loving wine. Elsewhere, he's a paranoid cosmic cowboy with stars rolling in and out of his ears, who wants to hear the gong of zero, whatever that is. His narrators are sardonically amused that they never fit in. This is the world of odd fables and mysterious events celebrated in songs from Howlin' Wolf's Smokestack Lightning to Gene Chandler's Duke of Earl. And who but Hurley would celebrate America's hero astronauts with a song about Captain Kidd's trip to the moon?
Captain Kidd done flipped his lid, he done left it behind. Captain Kidd done flipped his lid, there ain't nothing left but grind. He locked himself in a rocket ship and he took an interplanetary trip. He locked himself in a rocket ship and he took an interplanetary trip. Captain Captain Kidd got to the moon. He was waving his saber in the air. Captain Kidd soon left the moon, cause there wasn't any wine up there.
The only players in the mid-60s folk scene who were anything like Hurley were the Holy Modal Rounders. They and their circle eventually collaborated with Hurley on one of the most delightful and offbeat albums of the rock era, Have Moisey. The reissued Blueberry Wine is still the perfect introduction to Hurley, however, not least because it includes the most forceful and vivid rendition of his most disturbing number, Werewolf Song.
He goes out in the evening when the bats are on the wing, and he's killed some young maiden before the birds sing. For the werewolf, for the werewolf, have sympathy, 'cause the werewolf is someone just like you and me.
Of all the songs about midnight ramblers and killers with hellhounds on their trails, Werewolf Song is the most haunting because it's so quiet and plaintive. It's a character sketch that asks you to have sympathy for the misogynist devil. The full moon comes up and guys just can't control themselves. In some ways, it's a relic of beatnik machismo. But Hurley makes it stick like folk wisdom. And while I don't accept that there's a killer inside ordinary men, Hurley's werewolf is, without question, a charismatic monster. He's the touch of evil that adds tang to the sad whimsies and earthly joys of Blueberry Wine.
Milo Miles is a music critic living in Cambridge. The reissue of Michael Hurley's debut album, called Blueberry Wine, is on Locust Music in Chicago. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Julian Hertzfeld. Dorothy Ferriby is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Just a bum. All the years that I lived, people say that my time's been wasted. Sitting by the fireside, dreaming all night, making love drunk in a mat beneath the pale moonlight.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, by Bantam Books, a division of Random House, publisher of They All Laughed at Christopher Columbus, An Incurable Dreamer Builds the First Civilian Spaceship by Elizabeth Weil, available in hardcover, from the Discovery Channel, presenting Behind the Headlines, a television event featuring Understanding Iraq and The Real Saddam, Friday at 9 p.m. on the Discovery Channel, and by Vintage Books, publishers of the new paperback collection of stories by Alice Munro, Hateship, Friendship, Courtship, Loveship, Marriage. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next edition of Fresh Air, actress Jodie Foster. Her movie Panic Room is out on DVD. Garrison Keillor talks about his book Lake Wobegon Summer 1956, which is now out in paperback, and David Edelstein reviews the new movie Autofocus. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.